Coming up, Christian Hammer joins us to share insights and lessons learned on his journey to CISO. And then Jonathan Pritchard reveals the pathway to better results if you think and act like a mind reader in our personal performance segment. And we got the latest in the security innovation and updates, including breaking news today on the huge acquisition Microsoft just made. Business Security Weekly starts now. It starts now, right now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals, by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show about security startups, how to secure your startup, and advice for security startups. It's Business Security Weekly. I need it from the top. Brought to you by, are you getting pressure to improve your data security? Would you like a faster, easier, better way to patch? Then you need to check out AutoMox. AutoMox is a cloud-native platform that patches and manages every endpoint, even remote servers and devices, including Windows, Mac, Linux, and third-party software, from a single dashboard. Improve your cyber hygiene, reduce your attack surface, and save 90% of the effort you spend patching. AutoMox, your patching system of record. Do you have a website, an external presence, employees, an office? Any of these things can be compromised and attacked. How are you defending your assets? Have you penetration tested your public assets? Start 2018 by taking a proactive approach to securing your vulnerable areas. Black Hills Information Security has been helping companies find their weaknesses since 2008. Email consulting at blackhillsinfosec.com and see how they can help you sleep better at night.
Hello and welcome to Business Security Weekly. We're at episode number 87 and we're recording it live Monday, June 4th, 2018. This is the show where we explore the business of security in an effort to improve the security of business. And our goal is simple. We want to be your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. I'm still Michael Santarcangelo. Hasn't changed. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. Your straight talking guy. I'm going to help you overcome friction, translate your value into understanding, and elevate performance to accelerate results. And that means the security scorecard that we're working on, the value prop scorecard, not security scorecard, is coming soon. Joining me from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, Paul, is it still snowing? Do you guys still have snow on the ground? Because down here, it's summer weight now.
It very well could snow today, I think. I almost had to turn the heat on in my car this morning, and it's June. It was terrible.
Well, as you can see, I busted out now my summer colors and the polos and stuff because it's hot down here.
Yeah, I almost wore a winter hat today. That's how cold it is. It's just terrible weather. Anyway, we're on a fantastic show, though, so it makes everything warmer.
We got a huge lineup today, and I'm really excited about it. And I'm really excited. Let's just get right into our conversation with Christian. So Christian is the Chief Information Security Officer at Harvard University. Tons of other accolades go around that. But what's really cool, especially as this show has evolved and we're really looking at the business of it, is Christian's one of the CISOs that I've worked with and talked with a lot about this idea, Paul, that we brought up on this program, influence without authority, and looking at how do you grow a team? Because a lot of people who are CISOs, it's kind of like individual contributor. Oh, look, I've got a team. Wait, now what? And then the team grows. What I'm learning is that you've kind of got your first hurdle at about 8 to 10 people, and you can manage it, but you're learning. Then you expand, you double it. And once you get past about 15, 16 people, it really, like, it's a completely different thing to work through all those different pieces. Christian is navigating it really well, despite his humility about it all. And so it's exciting to have Christian here. So Christian, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
It's exciting. All right, so let's start by talking about something that's not controversial at all, the skills gap. Because this is a thing I think is interesting, and you're in higher ed. And so when you think about the skills gap, is this an issue for you?
I think in some sense it's an issue for everybody, and certainly lots of people are talking about it. I'm part of a group that's trying to figure out how higher ed can help with some of the problems in information security. And I heard an interesting stat recently. I don't remember the exact numbers, but they had surveyed different college programs that were turning out graduates in, you know, information security, information assurance, and something like 80% of them were, or at least a majority, were trained penetration testers. And when they surveyed businesses for what they were looking for, maybe not surprisingly, something like less than 20% of the positions are actually for that. So I think right now we've haven't quite figured out how to do this right yet.
So it's a little bit less that there's a shortage, and it's a little bit more that there, maybe there's a mismatch in terms of the way that we're thinking about it and prepping people for it. I'm going to add too, I'm curious, Paul, your take on this as well as yours, Christian. I've talked to a number of CISOs who said, look, we've got people coming out of college, well-trained, great degrees, good grades, smart, articulate, good theory, not a lot of hands-on experience, and therefore they kind of struggle when we throw them into the new positions. Are you guys finding that too?
I would say for sure
that's a challenge, right? And in fact, as we've gotten more of these degree programs, you get people maybe with less hands-on experience with computers and networks, and that's something that I wish we could get a lot more into kind of either the undergraduate education or some kind of apprenticeship or something like that, where people can get an opportunity to see what they're really defending.
One of the major issues for me in talking about the skills gap, or I think just a mismatch is a more appropriate term, is that students come out of college and they're like, yeah, I have some hands-on experience. Like I did some kind of internship, or I did a work study, or I had a job and I worked in a SOC. And I'm like, that's great. What did you do? And it's like, well, I looked at a dashboard and I used these security tools, and I told people what I thought, might have been interesting or responded to a certain level of threat. And I'm like, that's great. I'm like, so, have you built a Linux system and built a network and understand TCP/IP? And they're like, no, but I have work experience. I'm like, no, you really don't. Sorry. It's not the right experience.
Well, yeah. And when we got started, Christian, you mentioned a comment too about, and you just started there in terms of understanding the broader perspective of it all. I mean, a lot of us, when we got started into it, it was do all this stuff. And oh, by the way, there's this security thing, but don't let these other things go wrong. And sometimes we get a little bit disconnected from that. But you're filling people. Your team has grown. So has this been a struggle for you, or how are you looking at it differently?
Well, I think, and this isn't news maybe to anybody, but one of the ways that we're our own worst enemy sometimes in this profession is that we write job descriptions maybe that we aren't even qualified for, right? And we think that the more that we can sort of pile on the skills, and you got to have a CISSP and all this, and then we wonder why we can't find anybody. And so what we found is that by really looking at the job descriptions and stripping out the stuff that actually doesn't matter, and whether that comes from looking at our team or looking at what our needs are, we've been able to focus a lot better on, so what actually is important and what are skills that we can kind of give people on the job. Tried to look in other places for people. As we look at the composition of our own team, very few of us come from a straight up CS background even, and that's okay, right? We all have a passion for it, and I think maybe that's the more important piece to look for. And we've tried to be out there in the community as we can, whether that's in person or, on various social media. And that's helped as well to kind of get the word out a little bit.
Oh, that's interesting. So what you're describing then is leadership, right? You're not just blanket stuff. You're figuring out what you need. You're carving it out. And you and I chat a little bit, and it's almost like if we want to talk about where there's real shortages, in fact, most people know I argue against the shortage routinely. But you said something like, well, actually, maybe we need to look at leadership. And I went, oh, okay. And just to be fair, I don't see it as a security problem. I think most organizations today have a leadership deficit, and they're working hard to fix that, which gives us this great opportunity in security. So let's talk about your journey to CISO. And we've picked out a couple different things. If we broke it down, and we did, because that's how we prepare here, three things. The first one you start with, I loved it. Lead from where you are. What does that mean?
So I think it can be easy sometimes in life to say, okay, well, I'm gonna wait for an event to happen, right? You give me the title, and then I'll start acting that way. And my perspective has been really to sort of do the opposite, right? If you want to be a leader, well, there's no reason why you can't start acting like one today. And what that means is, so go find a hard project, right? Go do the dirty work, the thing that nobody wants to do. Maybe it's politically charged. Maybe there's other challenges with it, but there are plenty of opportunities for folks. And it's going to take you out of your comfort zone a little bit. And you may find that you don't like it, and that's okay. But don't wait, find something. There's plenty of opportunities around.
And so do you see this as collateral duty? This is the and also I take on one of these things, or does this kind of become the focal point? Like, you focus on this because it's good for the business. It's good for you. You learn and you get to prove your results.
So I think one sort of turns into the other, right? Again, you can't tomorrow say, well, I want this to be the focus of the work that I do, but you pick up sort of a small piece and people will notice. And all of a sudden, maybe you start getting assigned to another thing, or maybe you go find the opportunity and ask for it. It's something you can't do kind of, you know, entirely in your free time. And I think along your journey, it's going to be something that becomes more and more central to the role that you're playing. But you get there piece at a time by just, you know, acting the part to start with.
All right. So let's get the second point. And I think this is going to be interesting and maybe some room here for discussion. How important is having a technical background? I mean, security today largely has been an IT function. People focus in on that. We battle around whether it's information security or cyber or however we want to call it. And there's constantly a debate. Well, you've got to have really good domain knowledge, or nah, you don't. Yeah, you got to have good technical chops. No, you don't. How do you see it?
Well, so to be clear, that's my background. I sort of call myself a recovering nerd, and I still love that stuff, right? But I think that also means that there are plenty of gaps in my background in a management and leadership position. And, you know, one thing that I think is really critical for anybody who wants to be in security leadership is one place that you're going to have to lead at some point or another is an incident response, right? And I'm not talking about, you know, going out and collecting memory and, you know, analyzing network packets and stuff like that, because there's a team to do that. And especially if you don't come from a technical background, you might not be comfortable with that, and that's fine. But it turns out in my experience, and I think when we look at some of the, you know, the more public incidents and where the criticism comes, the big challenges are, how do you coordinate a team, right? How do you prioritize? How do you figure out, well, what are the critical decisions that we need to make, and then ensure that those actually get made? And maybe the most important lesson that I think we continue to learn is about communication, right? That might be about internal communication. It might be about how you're communicating externally. And I think you can take these skills and sort of certainly extrapolate beyond just straight up incident response as things that are going to be really important as a leader. Doesn't matter what your background is. So, you know, my own perspective on this is that everybody's got gaps, and it's about building a team that helps complement each other and yourself. So, you know, you could come from a hardcore tech background, and that's fantastic, but there's other things that you're going to have to work on. And maybe you don't, and that's okay too. You know what? If you have the passion and you got the right folks around you, you can figure out the rest.
I love that. And obviously, I'm going to be partial to the discussion around communications, but I'll point out that, and this is where you and I started working on this idea of influence without authority. And we've talked about it a lot over the last year. And in fact, you even give me some insights that in higher ed, it's almost the tip of the spear in terms of how we start to think about this, because you're working with faculty, often tenured. You can't just go tell them how it's going to be. It doesn't really work that way. And so you have to figure out that communications angle to it. I'm starting to see a lot of other CISOs come to the same sort of conclusion across industries. Oof, if we don't communicate to the business, if they don't see our value, if they don't understand why we're doing what we're doing, we kind of get torpedoed. So when you're working on this from coordinating and figuring out incident response, do you find that by improving that process and improving those communications, does that then create other opportunities for you and the team?
Oh, absolutely, right? And I think opportunity is exactly the right word, because it gets you the chance to be out there in the community and to meet people and start to, you know, understand what their problems are. And if they see that that's your perspective, that you actually want to understand what it is they do and figure out how you can help, you know, it might not happen every time, but more often than not, couple months later, there's a phone call or an email of, hey, you know, we're working on this thing and we thought you might be able to help that you never would have heard of otherwise.
Yeah, I love that. So then your third option or your third suggestion is be reasonable. Now, I love this because to me, this is flipping the script. So what do you mean when you say be reasonable?
Well, I think information security has a reputation historically, and some of this is earned and maybe some of it isn't, as, you know, we're the fear, uncertainty, and doubt people. And not that that sometimes doesn't have a place to help people understand the, you know, the severity of the consequences and some of the things that we do. But the reality is very few of us work in an organization whose purpose is information security, right? Usually the mission is something else. And in my case, that's supporting teaching, learning, and research. So my job is really, well, how do I help people innovate, right? And I want to make sure that they do that in a way that minimizes risk, but I think sometimes we mistake our role as that of eliminating all risk. And when we do that, people tend to see through it and they feel like, okay, well, you're not here to help me at all, so I'm just going to go around you.
How often are they surprised then? Like, I got to imagine people come to these meetings and they're like, oh, grumble, we had to invite security. And you're like, hey, that sounds great. We can totally make that work. How often are they like looking around for cameras and Ashton Kutcher to jump out and tell them they've been punked?
So, you know, honestly, that's the best reaction. And somewhere I have, and I wish I could remember the exact quote, but an email from a researcher that said something like, you know, I thought you folks were going to be just a complete pain to work with, but we're buddies now. And it was terrific, right? That's exactly what we're looking for. And it doesn't always happen, and that's okay. Because again, we can't just let people do whatever they want. Our job is to help, you know, think about and minimize risk. But it is nice when you get that sort of, oh, wow, you know, I thought you were here to just say no to everything that I wanted to do, but you actually care about what I'm doing.
Yeah, you know, well, I think that culture that you can build within an organization, especially a university, and it was one that I used when I worked for a university as well. And I wish I had looked upon it the way I do today. So in my role, right, I wanted to make sure people learn from me. I think what I didn't underscore enough was I also learned from them. I think if I were to go back and do it today, it would be more of an even split. Because a lot of times the people you're working with are very smart on the cutting edge of research. They need to learn from you how security works to reduce risk, but you can learn a lot from them. And oftentimes a lot of innovative ideas came from working with those people in research and their views upon what we were implementing of security. And I think establishing that relationship in a learning environment especially works in university, but can also extend to other organizations as well, for sure.
Well, yeah. And I just want to point out, Christian, and maybe you can give us some more insights on it. It's, You nuanced that you want to be reasonable and support people, but we can't say yes to everything. And I think that's from a risk perspective, but it's also there's only so many hours in the day. There's only so many members of the team. And if we flip that and say, okay, I'm never going to say no again. I'm always going to say yes. Woo, that could get you in hot water too. How do you balance what you say yes to and how you politely help somebody understand, yeah, that's not going to happen?
So I think it's got to start with the understanding of, well, what is it that they're trying to do and why, right? Because sometimes you can just give them a different alternative and that's the end of the conversation. Everybody gets to go away happy. And, you know, sometimes you do have to find a different way to say no or maybe say, well, let's try to do it this way. But I think it starts with understanding what it is they're trying to do. And sometimes that may be enough to just say, hey, you know what? That's below the cut line. I'm good with that. There's really not enough risk here that I need to worry about it. And I'm going to move on to one of these where I need to spend more time either on the analysis or developing the alternatives.
You know what I love about that? That just tripped in my head. If we start telling people they did a good job with the risk and yeah, you're good versus, oh, we should look at this. I envision over time, they come to you with real risk and say, hey, Christian, we know these things are okay, but what about this? We're concerned about this. And there's got to come a point where you look at it and smile and go, yes, wow, that's, yeah, we got to get involved. How do we help? Has that started to happen yet?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of exactly as you say, right? And I think you're able to maybe develop some credibility so that when you do need to say, hey, you know what, sorry, this one we need to look at a different way and here's why. People realize that you're not saying that because that's just your sort of gut reaction to everything, but that you've actually given it some thought and it seems to be important.
Oh, that's a great point. That credibility is so important. All right, so let's talk about some of your lessons learned or some of your surprises. I know you were telling me that when you got started, somebody said, hey, here's this new policy. All you got to do, Christian, you can cut the ribbon. You're going to claim some credit. It's a good quick win. How did that turn out?
So yeah, it sounded fantastic at the time. And, it was an interesting lesson and a bit of a, you know, a difficult decision for me because I started to hear from some folks for whom I had a lot of respect and the community did that maybe they weren't that comfortable with it. Well, my first instinct was to kind of, you know, say, hey, wait a minute. I was told I just needed to get this across the line and this is going to be great. I ended up deciding that, well, you know what, let's go rehash this and try to, you know, start over. And I think it goes back to, and I think you mentioned this a little earlier, the getting an honest assessment, right? And that's effectively what that was. And the follow-up was just, okay, well, now I got to make a decision. And it wasn't a decision that I necessarily wanted to make, but I think, you know, looking back, it's absolutely been for the best.
No, that makes a lot of sense. But let's talk about honest assessments, because I think the other thing too, especially for people who come from the ranks and, or were individual contributors, and then now we're in charge of the team. We sometimes have blinders on, or we see the good, or we have that level of camaraderie, and we don't necessarily want to take a hard look at the team. But you talk about the importance of getting an honest assessment. Why does that matter?
Well, I think that one of the things that tends to happen, and again, this is a reputation our industry has earned for better or for worse, which is that, you know, sometimes we tend to think, well, we're really the experts on this and our job. And Paul kind of said this earlier, you know, we're going to help educate the people, right? We're going to tell you what you need to do because we know everything about this and you don't. And you know, that was sort of an experience that I had, was that the way that the community was sort of experiencing that was really pretty negative. And, in fact, we were coming across as though we thought we were the experts, but maybe we weren't. And we've tried to flip that around, actually, and say, you know what, we're going to be the experts on information security when everybody else says that we are. And I've found that to be such a refreshing change, because first of all, it means we don't have to know everything. And second of all, I think it just changes the way that we approach situations.
Now, I love that. So when you get this assessment and you sit down with the team, I'm gathering, and I know we've talked a bit, so your approach is pretty straightforward, and I'm guessing you'd kind of share some of those findings. How did the team react to that? Because I kind of imagine somebody new in the position says, wait a minute, I've got information that maybe we're not as awesome as we think we are, but God, I can't afford to lose anybody because, you know, there's a shortage. And what? How do you resolve that, and how do you push forward once you get that honest look at the team and how you're perceived across the business?
Well, I think you've got to start with where you are, right, and sharing the honest assessment that you've gotten in the same terms that you got it. It doesn't help to sugarcoat it, and that was one of the more difficult things that I had to do, was to deliver that to a group of people that, hey, you know, I've asked around and this is how we're perceived right now. And then it's, you know, it's sort of not about what happened that led to that, but what you do next. And, you know, in this particular case and looking back on it again, I think it worked out all right for us. It was about laying out, well, what's the vision? Where do we want to be? And not so much what's every single step that we need to get there. But it really did start with this idea that, hey, let's decide that we're going to be the experts on this when everybody else says that we are. And the rest of it just sort of started to flow naturally, right? And that might not work for everybody, and that's okay. But I'll tell you what, enduring a little bit of pain and getting folks on board with the place that you want to be is a lot better in the long term than saying, well, gosh, you know, as much as I'd like to be this way, I'm gonna accept some of the you know, the brutal honesty that I've heard, because I just can't afford to not.
Now, we just focus on the negative side, right? Because you're bringing less than flattering information back to the team. Did you find anybody kind of nodded their head and said, "Yeah, I've been worried about that too. Wow, this is this is a team I want to be part of. I want to be recognized as an expert because of results, not because I went in and told them I worked for security." Were you surprised that anybody almost embraced this as, whew, it's about time?
I'm not sure it was quite it's about time, but I think there was a little bit of, you know, wow, that was a punch in the gut, and that's not how I see myself. That's not what I want to be, right? And I would replace sort of the I with we. That's not how anybody saw themselves, and that's not how anybody wanted to be. So I think it's, for a lot of folks, it's real easy to sort of get on board to, well, what's the better tomorrow, right, that you talk about.
Christian, I'm sorry. So my question is, and this was particularly challenging for me in university space, and then I realized that everyone really has this challenge, and that is when we talked about incident response, one of the challenges is that you have an influence without control in an incident. You have to enable and encourage, and you definitely don't want to tell them that they have to do something that they necessarily don't want to do, that they may have to drop what they're doing to work on this incident. But you have to do that across your environment. That could be a faculty member or an IT person in a different department. That could be your desktop support group, your server group, your other application group. Like, there's lots of groups in the university that may have to stop what they're doing to work on an incident that is way outside of your control. How have you been able to handle that situation today in your current role?
So ideally, it starts with kind of the preparation of developing the relationships, right? And it goes back to the credibility that we touched on earlier. If people feel like, you know, when they hear from you and when you say, you know what, this one's important, that means something, then it gets an awful lot easier. But you can't do that all the time, right? Sometimes that works out. Certainly the more work that you put into building relationships in advance will pay off. And when it doesn't, it's just got to be the focus on the here's why, right? Because people hear the here's what I need you to do. And as you say, that's often not what they wanted to do or had prioritized or had time for. But if you can at least try to, you know, explain this is why we think that this is important and this is why I need you to do it, it at least cushions the blow a little bit, right? I think that the folks that we don't want to be is the people who come in and say, I need you to do this because security, right? Right. People see through that. People are smart.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about one of my favorite questions. What problem are you trying to solve? You've talked about this already. You don't have to know everything. But one of the also things that I think is interesting, I talked to a lot of CISOs and they feel like they have too many plates spinning in the air. They can't let any of them down. They got to get some new ones up. And, I'm just completely overwhelmed. I don't even know where to focus. How do you look at this? Because you've got some pretty good insights on thinking about problems and questions a little bit differently. What have you learned in your journey?
Well, I would say that that's a journey, you know, in which I'm in the middle of at best. I don't know what I've got for a ton of insight there, but I would say one sort of change that I made in my thinking was away from trying to be the person who has or can find all of the answers, right? And that's especially hard, I think, for somebody with a technical background. You probably got promoted for being the person who can solve the hard problems or knowing the answer, being able to find the answer. And the thing that kind of changed my perspective was focusing on, yeah, but if I'm answering the wrong question, then it doesn't matter. And so if you can spend more time figuring out, well, am I even asking the right question before I jump to trying to figure out the answer, I think it can help, you know, maybe prioritize a little bit differently than you might otherwise.
Yeah, I like that a lot. All right. So a lot of people listening, I know that when Paul and I go and we talk with people, we have a lot of folks that are new into their leadership positions. And we have a lot of folks that have told us, hey, I'm loving this. You're changing my career. I'm taking the advice and I'm getting myself ready to take on a security leadership position. If you think back to it, what's some advice you have for anybody who's either newly in a position, maybe they've already been there, but newly, let's think about newly in a position or they aspire to it and they're actively working toward it. What are some things that you think would ease their transition?
So the first one, and this is pretty in vogue, so I apologize for sort of repeating it again, but it was important to me, is get a mentor, right? And that doesn't mean going and finding somebody and saying, hey, would you be my mentor? I think maybe the more down-to-earth way that this actually happens in the real world is just ask for advice, right? And that may lead to a series of conversations, and all of a sudden you'll look back and say, oh, wow, this person's been really influential for me. I was lucky this happened to me a little bit by accident, but it's one of the best things that happened to me for sure. And it really did start from the context of getting advice.
The other thing you talked about is just start. Just start now. We opened up with that. And I feel like that's one of those things that's simple, not easy. So we gave them the example of pick a project or something else. What other ways do you think about, you know, action over inaction or action over talking instead of that, well, one day I want to be a CISO? When to start doing it now, what do they need to think about? Or how would they do it differently?
You know, again, it's find the right thing, and it doesn't have to be the big giant, you know, project that's going to make the difference for the organization. But honestly, find the thing that nobody wants to do, right? And I'm not talking about necessarily the complete grunt work, but maybe something that's really politically charged, right? The one that everybody's a little bit worried about. And not that that doesn't involve risk, but there's also a lot of reward in that. And I think, you know, just don't shy away from it because it looks hard, and, you know, that it'll look different for everybody in each situation. But I think that's the kind of thing that you're looking for to, again, just lead from where you are.
Now, I've noticed every time that we've been in person together, you're always dressed well. You've got a suit. You got a nice shine on your shoes. Is that intentional, or are you just trying to be spiffy when I'm around?
It's not just for you, Michael. you know, it's funny because this is the thing, and I realize people have different perspectives on this. And for many of us who grew up in IT, you know, one of the nice things is maybe I can wear jeans or shorts or whatever. I actually do this intentionally. And believe me, on the weekends, I don't dress like this. But I think, you know, the CISO is really part of the business, or I suppose one of the struggles that we've had writ large is, you know, how are we taken seriously by the rest of the business? How do you get a seat at the table in the boardroom? All these kinds of questions. And, you know, it may be a silly little thing, but the first part is, well, you know, look like you belong there. And, you know, that may mean making some different compromises about how you're dressing. But I think if you dress like you're in IT, that's what people are going to think of you. And if you look around you at the business and you dress like that, then, you know, that's kind of the context in which people are going to put you. So again, I do it intentionally, and I actually think it's important.
I tend to agree. I mean, I've written on it. People don't always like it because we still want that meritocracy, but I think it's an important point. Christian, this was fantastic. I mean, it's lots of ideas. I obviously took lots of notes during our prep, and I always appreciate that, but that usually signals to me our audience is going to get a lot out of it. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share some of your experience, because it's, you know, you and I talked a little bit, and Paul and I've talked about this quite a bit too. People get excited, like, you know, at a conference, they think, oh, I want to go do the talk on how to do the latest memory forensics. I want to go do whatever. And what we're starved for is, yeah, but how did you make that work? And now that you have, what would you learn from it? What did you do? I think you gave people a really good blueprint or recipe for them as they head down this pathway. And so thanks for joining us. And of course, we'll tap you again and bring you back and have some more detailed conversations. But this was awesome. And I appreciate it a lot.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, Christian.
All right. So with that, we're going to take a quick break. It's a good chance to check us out at securityweekly.com. We got a ton of shows. We've got you covered. Enterprise, individual, whatever you're trying to do, we've got it. And you can check out our on-demand content. When we come back, Jonathan Pritchard from Like a Mind Reader Training joins us. You're going to want to check this out. Be right back.
Domain Tools help security analysts turn threat data into threat intelligence. They take indicators from your network, including domains and IP addresses, and connect them with nearly every active domain on the internet. Those connections drive risk assessments, help profile attackers, guide online fraud investigations, and map cyber activity to attacker infrastructure. Fortune 1000 companies, global government agencies, and leading security solutions vendors use the Domain Tools platform as a critical ingredient in their threat investigations and proactive defenses. For more information, visit securityweekly.com/domain tools. Today's determined attackers easily bypass even the most advanced network defenses. Trying to ramp up staff to detect their backdoors can cost thousands of dollars and take months, even years. With Active Countermeasures AI Hunter, we enable junior analysts to detect even the most advanced backdoors in a matter of hours. Sign up for a demo and purchase our product today by visiting activecountermeasures.com/BSW. Active Countermeasures, make every analyst a hunter.
All right, well, welcome back. We had a little bit of a break there, and there's a lot of excitement and buzz for our next guest, Jonathan Pritchard. Jonathan is a business consultant, and he specializes in the psychology of communication, negotiation, influence, and sales. In other words, he's our new best friend in security because we need all of these things. And he spent 15 years traveling the world as a mentalist. He works with some pretty impressive name companies, helping them engage better. And as Paul is definitely going to bring it, he's got a tremendous background in Kung Fu. And he can tie all of this together for us. So we're real excited because this is part of our performance and our personal improvement segment that we're going to keep bringing to you. So, Jonathan, welcome to Business Security Weekly, and thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Paul is excited. I was excited, and Paul's excited, so we're all excited.
I saw that Jonathan studied Kung Fu, and then we got talking, and then it went really off the rails. We like had a Kung Fu nerd out session, so...
It was good. I hope we recorded some of it. It'll be good outtakes. All right. So Jonathan, we start with this in terms of being a mentalist, being a mind reader. What does that mean?
Right. That's kind of one of the first questions is, what exactly is a mentalist and why should I care? So basically, to me, a mentalist is kind of like a magician that graduated to mind reading tricks. But it's not that I'm psychic or I've got the special mojo. It's just that I'm a really good communicator and I know how to manage information that the audience sees and doesn't see to make it look like I can read minds. So it's just applied psychology and leveraging information at the right time and to do that to an effect, right? Make people believe I can get inside their heads and know exactly what it is that they're thinking, but I'm not psychic.
Is that something that you had a knack for and then polished up? Or was it something you saw someone else do and went, oh, I'm going to go learn how to do that?
Well, a little column A, a little bit of column B. I kind of started out when I was a kid with magic tricks because I was super shy and it was an easy way for me to start conversations with people and make friends. And there's kind of tricks with, excuse me, there are tricks with playing cards, tricks with cards, and then there are these mind reading tricks. And those always seem to freak people out. You could find somebody's playing card, okay, that's fun, but telling them what street they grew up on, that's terrifying. And that was interesting to me. And then over the years, got better and better at it. And then in college, got interested in understanding not only how these mind reading tricks work, but why they're even possible in the first place. And then that sent me down just a lifelong rabbit hole of understanding motivational psychology, how we fundamentally understand and interact with reality through our senses and our precognitive processes that dictate what we're even aware of in the first place. But it just goes all over the place because it is a fundamental human process, right? So this isn't just some kind of psychological research that only applies to this one group. It's all human beings across the board.
Now, so Jonathan, when I think of a mind reading trick, I think of the, you know, person who has an earpiece and then there's another person with Google like behind the curtain, like feeding them information. So I mean, give us an example of what would be like a mind reading trick and kind of how it works. And obviously,
right. Well, that
magician
that
means you're probably not going to tell us exactly
method.
How. Yeah, but right, yeah, that right. is one method, right?
And that's called a hot reading, mm-hmm. right? So the difference is, like, a mentalist is an honest liar. And they say, hey, I'm going to be lying to you on stage, but it's to effect, and it's for the show, and it's all for fun. And then we go from there. But if you're going to a tarot card reader or a spiritualist or a medium who has that earpiece or does the Google foo on you before you show up, right, you're paying money to get in touch with the spirits. And what you're really paying for is them to have Googled you, mm-hmm. right? So that's fraud. So that's why, to me, it's a big difference between sure. the legitimacy and honesty. So like a mind reading trick is I have ways of making people think they've made the choice freely when it's really my plan that they're operating under.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I can have a prediction in full view, like in an envelope, and then have them go through a decision-making process. And at the end of it, they feel like they were in control the whole time. But really, it was me navigating through all these branches of how they could possibly decide to do and have an out for each one that eventually gets me to the outcome that I want.
So basically, you're talking about a sales process.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why it was blowing my mind, because for 15 years, I was traveling the world doing this stuff on stage, mm-hmm. and I was using the applied psychology to make people laugh and forget their problems for an hour. But then I started looking into business and business gurus and all these business books, and they're all talking about the psychology of sales from this story about something that happened to somebody else that they probably made up, right? Mm-hmm. Or they're talking about this psychological research that falls apart when you try to replicate it. And I was like, wait a minute, I know these principles better than these guys. And not only that, I've been using them in my own business to travel the world, perform in Vegas, consult with Chris Angel, do all these kinds of things. And I can show them in the context of a presentation, involve the audience in a way that they experience it firsthand, in a way that they literally can't forget for years. Right. So what are you going to remember more? The story some business guru told you about that happened to his grandpappy back in the day, or experiencing it real time and going, no, I know that guy. We sit together and I know he wasn't a stooge. He wasn't a plant. That wasn't something you can find on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And that Jonathan guy read his mind and then showed us the techniques of how it all worked and how it applies to business in the sales process, designing your website. It's all just human communication. That's all right. It is. That's why it applies in so many different domains and why it's so useful.
It's so timely too, because I'm actually taking some of these concepts I've learned about sales process and business from Michael and our guest and Michael's reading recommendations and applying them to a talk to social engineers and talking about how social engineering is the same, similar fundamental concepts and how to apply those to your business and how to apply those to your interpersonal or inter-office communications so that you can be a more effective leader or have better relationships at work and teach other people how to, you know, be leaders. So that's awesome.
Exactly. And that's the whole thing. A magic show, a mind reading show, any kind of presentation is social engineering. As the presenter, you have to navigate and lead a whole room full of people through an experience that you've designed. If you leave it up to chance, you're going to be an awful presenter. So you have to understand exactly what effect do I want to have on the audience? What do I want them walking away with? And then walking that backwards to build your strategy of how am I going to get to that end point? And then you define the effect, then figure out your methods and strategies. Then you practice so that at showtime you can execute, right? But I've designed this experience and I've been through my show a couple thousand times. And the volunteer, this is the first time they're experiencing this dynamic. So they may think of something funny and witty to say, but chances are I've heard it 900 times before.
It's kind of like when you work in the medical field and you perform exams or imaging and people have the same jokes and sometimes I can't help myself and I make a joke and then I look at them like, you've heard that probably 500 times, huh?
Exactly. And for me, I love it in the context of a presentation or a show, because the first time I hear a new joke, I'm surprised by it and I can laugh. But then that immediately after the show, I sit down and go, all right, what am I going to say the next time I hear that? So then the next time it happens, I've got that right there and it makes me look like a genius. Mm-hmm. Boy, he is just so fast on his feet. He's so quick.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I've just been in exactly this dynamic a lot more than you have, so I've got more experience with it. That's why I don't understand why hecklers try to battle comedians. It's like, listen, guy, you are not equipped to be in this situation. Good luck going down in flames.
Right.
But so it's that not makes as, a lot of sense.
It's not as simple as asking people what they want. I mean, certainly that is a strategy, but oftentimes what they say they really want or how they got to, you know, wanting or needing that is not really the truth.
Right. And it really is the worst way to put together your offerings or whatever, because people have a problem. Well, they don't actually have that problem. What they think their problem is a symptom of the problem they're not even aware of. Mm-hmm. Because if they were aware of what the root was, they would be able to address it, and then they wouldn't have that issue anymore. So if you've had an issue longer than 6 months, you don't understand what the problem is, and you need an expert. And don't try to do surgery on yourself. You're good at whatever it is you're good at. you haven't spent a lifetime understanding how people think, how they navigate reality, and really getting to the root cause of what's motivating the problems. So you've got to have a coach. You've got to have an outside perspective on what the actual issue is, because if you have your problem, you're not the person to solve it.
Yeah. So let's talk about...
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, I just want to talk about the transition too, because I want to make sure that we give people some actionable strategies here too that they can take away. And of course, we're going to let them know where they can get your book and explore working with you and stuff like that. But then how do you make the transition? I mean, this is a great conversation. You're obviously talented at what you do. You're good on the stage. You've consulted a lot of really good people. So then how do you say, I want to start coaching people? Like what led to that?
It was doing shows. And I worked a lot of colleges to start out, and college kids don't know that I'm not a rock star. So to them, I am. So I do the 70-minute mind reading show, and then I've got a 45-minute autograph line afterwards where I'm signing posters and doing the whole rock star thing. And I started hearing, like, it clicked. For years, I've been hearing people going, oh my goodness, you're living the dream. You're traveling the world, getting paid to do what you love. I can't even imagine doing that. And it was that phrase that eventually clicked. It's like, if you can't even imagine a different path, how are you going to make it real? So my way of thinking and living is so far outside the standard social narrative that I started talking to the college kids after the show going, oh man, here's how I did it. Found a mentor. Here's how I did that. Here's how I learn new skills. Here's how I market myself. Here's how I do all this stuff. And then a couple years later, I started getting emails back from people saying, hey, thanks for taking that 10 minutes to talk to me. It made all the difference in the world, and here's what I'm doing now because of it, and it's all thanks to you. And that was really when I realized, oh man, this actually has value. This actually has worth beyond just being the dancing monkey on stage and helping people forget their problems for an hour. The psychology can help people solve their problems long term. All right, now I have to share this. I have to teach people. I've got to take people behind the curtain and show them why they keep making the mistakes that they do, how to be aware of them, and then how to change your fundamental operating procedures to get different results and to shape your beliefs in a way that is more productive and helpful in your life instead of just being stuck in that same spiral again and again and again.
Yeah, and
that was how I made the switch over.
They want to break out of that spiral. So when you made that transition and you started offering some of that coaching, did you find people just mobbed right to you and they went, yeah, it's about time, teach me? Or were you kind of surprised that they went from loving it and asking about it, but when time came to actually do the work, it was a little different?
It's a little different because the people who need it the most are the least likely to search for it. Hmm. What, this burnout? This is fantastic. This is wonderful. Being ineffective as a leader? Boy, howdy, I sure have to work harder now. And that makes me feel better because working hard is what works, not working smart and being effective. Right? So it's kind of like the top level CEOs that could use mindset coaching the most are the least likely to pursue it, which is ironic, but it's how people work. So you have to frame what it is that you do in terms that they value. Do you want to be more awesome? Do you want to be more respected? Do you want to work less? And they're like, yeah, right? Well, the way to do that is stop being so awful. You are a horrible person. You're horrible at your job. You're bad at leadership. You are the problem. Your employees aren't the issue. Your sales process isn't necessarily the issue. It's you allowing it to be the issue that is the root of the problem. So how about you stop being awful? I'll show you how, right? That's not going to work. that doesn't really engender a lot of love and loyalty to people.
No, I bet it doesn't. So then how do you reach people? How do you get started? And somebody who's kind of thinking about this right now, because let me ask the question differently. I think a lot of people who are in security say, wait, hold on though. I just got promoted to a position of leadership and now you're telling me I should go get help? No, they just hired me. If I go get help, isn't that a signal I'm a failure? How do you help people get over that to realize, no, actually, this is the sign of success?
Yeah, getting help and training yourself makes you so much more valuable to the company. It's that old thing of kind of like a top level down. They think, well, what if I train my employees and get them up to rock star level and then they leave? Well, the only other option is, what if you don't educate them and they stick around? Now you got a whole company full of people who can't do their job well. So taking the initiative to work on your own skills on your own time is one of the best things you could possibly do, because that is one of the few super positive signals to leadership that you're worth investing in. Because why should I invest in your well-being if you won't even do it yourself? Because I can't push you to do it. But if you show me that you're coachable, I'm going to go on for hours coaching you, because I know that my knowledge and experience will be put to good use. But somebody who thinks they're already good enough, you can't teach them anything. Their cup is already full, right? You got to pour it out before you can fill it up again. So taking the initiative to teach yourself is the best thing you can do for your work, for your company, for yourself, your relationships, because no amount of business tactics or business strategies are going to solve personal issues that manifest themselves in your job and life. And that's what every problem is, a personal issue. It just happens to be a personal issue showing up at work. That's all it is. So everybody needs a coach. Everybody needs training. Everybody needs help. And the people who wake up to that fact are the people who make the most out of their life.
I completely agree with that.
I was just going back in my head with people that I've worked with.
Yep. You'll see, Paul and I sometimes share a single mind. You maybe pick that up. And so we tend to say some of the same things. So here's one of the things that I'm looking at. Again, so the person who comes to you, do you find that there's a typical starting point? Because you mentioned the importance of mindset, and it's fascinating because, to be really blunt, I think a lot of times we struggle with that in security. When we get started, it's not, hey, congratulations, you're part of the security team. It's, hey, dude, you're going to screw up. And when you do, the world's going to come down on your head. Don't F up. That was my first day on the job. When you screw up, it's going to really suck for you. And if we look at, you know, kids, we tend to motivate kids with praise, and we show them the pathway. And of course, we offer constructive criticism, and we try to do the criticism sandwich and all sorts of other crap that I don't think really works. But then we get to adults, and it's all just like, wow, you screwed this up, and you screwed this up, and you got to get to all these things, and I don't like how you did this. So when you talk about that mindset, somebody says, okay, Jonathan, I think I need some of this coaching. Do you find that there tends to be a pretty consistent starting place, or is everybody different?
The starting place is showing people what assumptions they have about the world that they take as fact, right? Mm. They believe this is how things are. Nope, that's how you see them. Mm. So it's really cool that you brought up the kids, because that's when all this stuff is installed, right? If you've been around children long enough, you know, they just talk nonstop about nothing, everything. Yes. They just will never shut up. Right. So that constant stream of narrative is just unending. From the moment they wake up until they go to bed, they're just babbling.
I find that, especially my middle son, Dean, he just likes to make declarations. Like, he's always declaring something.
Dean is the mayor.
Exactly.
Dean has never met a stranger.
The other day, Dean was like, made his declaration, just one of several. And he's like, Dad, I'm not wearing any underwear today.
And you were like, neither am I. Welcome to the club.
Like, all right, thanks for that. You know what? We're already out of the house. There's not much I can do about it now. So we're just going to go with it.
Right, exactly. And then eventually you just got to like, oh, please, would you just for 5 minutes just shut up? Just 5 minutes. Just that's all I ask, right? And eventually the kid learns, not everybody wants to hear everything I have to say all the time, mm-hmm. right? But that babble doesn't go away. It just goes inside, mm-hmm. right? So we constantly have that voice in our head narrating what we're doing, making declarations, telling us what we're capable of doing. And we've been doing it so long that it's background noise, but you're not even consciously aware of it. It's that you're so good at telling yourself those things over and over and over again that you're not even aware of it, in the same way that you're not consciously aware of making a letter when you're handwriting, right? Mm. So those early childhood experiences kind of install, this is how I have to behave to get love and attention. This is how I have to behave to get reward from friends. This is how I have to behave, right? All of those things about how you've learned to have your needs met, you just get so good at it that you think this is the only way it's possible. And it's not necessarily the most effective, because what five-year-old would you trust to make any of your choices right now in your life, right? But you're still operating off the same mental software that you installed in childhood. So you're not even aware of what's running. So you need somebody like me to come in and go, all right, let me ask you some questions. And those questions highlight your beliefs about how the world works, how you have to work in the world, how other people see you. You've got to break it down to its most fundamental level, challenge those beliefs, show them why those are just preferential beliefs that they have and aren't empirical reality. Show them more effective strategies for getting their needs met, and showing them more effective strategies to communicate with other people that will help them achieve their goals. And that's how you make them more effective as managers, as human beings, really. So it all starts with kind of breaking them down, showing them how they navigate the world in a way that they think is fact when it's really just their preference. Then showing them multiple strategies that are applicable to multiple dimensions, and giving them a much bigger toolbox to use these tools and implements and mental approaches to conflict, to management, to conversation, to creating rapport, right? Instead of just going, sorry, this is how
I'm
I am. Just,
I'm still stuck on letting my five-year-old make all of my decisions. And right? How, like, awesome and hilarious and frightening that is all at the same time. Like, mm-hmm. Awesome, like, dietary choices of my five-year-old are awesome. Like, if you're a vegetarian, like, you're going to starve. He's bacon, hot dogs, and steak. That would be fantastic, right? But, so, yeah, some of the other things, not so much. Dean has, a brace on because he, you know, fell and stuff. Because and it's funny when you said that, because I actually just was coaching my five-year-old on making good choices and what the difference is between a poor choice and a bad, really about risk management in life. Because Dean, as Michael knows, had some interactions with my family. Dean's he's a little reckless sometimes, a little reckless.
Yeah. Make choices that create more opportunities for you after you've made the choice. Mm. That's kind of my rule of thumb.
Is that what you tell your five-year-old?
I haven't made that particular mistake of having children. Yeah. I know my limits, and that's one of them. That has enabled me to live the rock star life that I lead without damaging my offspring. Is to not have them.
I lose a lot of sleep worrying about the damage I've done. But what I think is interesting is, what you're describing too is the importance of what a lot of people call inner work, but it's that self-knowledge. It's to be an effective leader, you have to know yourself and you have to understand where you came from. And then I look at it simple. You can choose to continue, or you can choose to reject it and replace it, right? Upgrade the software, I guess, if we kept it in that way. Yeah. But I also know, and I would be remiss if we didn't bring up Kung Fu. You're a practitioner of Kung Fu, and it's related. You see a lot of parallels to that, and I know that Paul gets excited about it. So tell us then, what's the connection to Kung Fu?
Well, here it's that there's an old Kung Fu saying that I'm going to butcher is, if you defeat 1,000 men in battle, you can still lose. But if you overcome and conquer yourself, you can't lose. Right. So it's mastering and controlling yourself. You win in every area of life. Right? So that is really what it's all about, is understanding, how do I work? How do I operate? What challenges have I had? How do I overcome them? once you've mastered that, you understand, wait a minute, this is how everybody works. This is the process that's running everybody's decision making. And since I have looked inside and done the inner work and know this process inside and out, I now know how to structure my communication or my sales process or my sales funnel or advertising, whatever. You now frame it in a way that's most effective to the other people.
Yeah, but
so you're leading them through your process instead of just letting them control the fight.
And it's, to speak to the martial arts aspect, a really fantastic and great legendary teacher will be able to identify that in their students. And I was fortunate enough to have a truly extraordinary teacher. And I would see him do that not just with me, but with the other students as well. He'd be like, yeah, no, like that's not the form for you. Or like, try this form. I think it's better suited, or this weapon or this strategy. Or when you're in sparring, he's like, don't ever do that again. That's not for you. This other tactic is going to work much better for you. And it's really customizing and allowed you to know yourself and know your body. Everyone's bodies are different, right? And so knowing where your strengths and weaknesses are was a large part of studying with a true art and a true master, right?
Exactly. So to me, martial arts and self-defense is just the art of having personal boundaries and being able to enforce them, right? That's integrity. If you don't have boundaries, people will walk all over you and not think twice about it. Mm-hmm. And then people who are used to walking all over you, the moment that you get boundaries, they run into your boundary. They hurt themselves on your integrity and then blame you for hurting them when it's really their bad behavior that created the situation in the first place. So it's having that integrity and that structure and that ability to maintain that structure in the context of a dynamic situation, that's where really high-level skills come into play, right? So if you've got those boundaries, you now can be more sensitive to when somebody's trying to violate them, whether it's a business partner or a client who, you know what, just give me that discount this one time. No, you either value what I do or you don't, and free advice is worth exactly what you pay for it. So no thanks, I'm not in favor of letting you steal from me. So I'm not going to do that, right? So it's just the science of having personal integrity that you start out in a physical dynamic, and it's the process of cultivating that physical skill that gives you the mental and emotional discipline to master yourself, which then enables you to have higher quality relationships in your personal life, which then bleeds into your business life. So there's no way that you can isolate and compartmentalize any of this stuff. You pull on one thread, you see how it applies across the board. How well do you take care of your body? How well do you take care of your emotions? How well do you maintain your mental skills, right? It's how you do any one of those things is how you do everything. So that's why the mentalism and mind reading and the martial arts and the body, a mind and body together, mastering it on both sides is essential to live a life of integrity and quality.
So tell us about your book then, because you've got me fired up, and this is stuff I love. Paul will tell you. I mean, you know, I'm you don't get to, everybody doesn't get to see me nod my head so much and smiling from ear to ear, and so I can't wait to go see what you've written. So tell us about the book. Where can people find more if somebody wants to work with you? How do they find you, Jonathan?
Gotcha. Well, thanks for letting me be a shameless plug hound. So the book is Think Like a Mind Reader. So I know I can't work one-on-one with everybody. So I wrote the book about the 21 conversations that I was just having with people over and over and over again. But what about this? What about that? You know what? Let me just put it all in a book and to help people understand the importance of mindset, where to start, how to improve their memory, how to discover their motivation, discipline, all that kind of stuff that will literally change your life. And the stuff that I used to go from growing up in a single wide trailer on a dirt road in the mountains of North Carolina, like that's where I grew up. And from there, I've traveled the world, entertained the troops, been on TV, all that stuff. These are the mindsets and the strategies and the way of thinking about the world that I used in my own life to create a life I love living. So that's what I put into the book. Think Like a Mind Reader, which is available on Amazon. So that's the place to order it. There is not an ebook version of it because the book itself you can use to fool your friends and use as a mind reading trick, which you can't do with an ebook version. So that is such a big part of helping people understand how other people think. Because once you can do a magic trick and pull it off well, you start to understand all the aspects of communication, the body language, the timing, the voice, the script, your physical actions, all of that work together to communicate. So that's in the book too. All right. So it's on Amazon.com. Just search for Think Like a Mind Reader and you'll find it. If you want to work with me as on a company level, like bring me in to do trainings on negotiation, presentation skills, influence, sales, all that kind of stuff, go to likeamindreader.com. And that's where all my speaking and group training stuff is. So that's the best place to find me. And you can find me on LinkedIn, on Twitter, all that good stuff. But likeamindreader.com is kind of my central hub. And from there, you can just go down the rabbit hole forever.
No, that's fantastic. And, you know, a lot of our listeners, that they like books. And I love your description of the way you've designed the book. And so we may be reaching out to you again in the future and ask you to come back and talk specifically about the book as we kind of get our business book club started at some point. But this has been brilliant. I really appreciate you making the time to chat with us because this is fantastic. So, guys, you can go find him. We'll put the link in the show notes. Make sure you've got the ability to go. And if you reach out to Jonathan, let us know how you like that. Jonathan, let us know if anybody reaches out to you. And
thank
with
you.
That, we're going to take a
I just remembered, if you do like the kung fu angle and doing that kind of thing, I also have battlereadyceo.com. That's me. That's the kind of kung fu coaching side of things. Like, stop worrying about it. What would you do if somebody were trying to punch you in the face? You would move. You would do something. So let's stop navel gazing and get to work. So
that's another way to get plugged in. Right.
Yeah.
So is that good then for other leaders or just CEOs?
I kind of work at the top of the pyramid, but anybody that's in a leadership role should check it out.
I think a lot of CISOs would benefit from that. And I know a lot of CISOs do martial arts and they might like that connection. So that's fantastic. All right. Well, so thank you, Jonathan. We're going to take a short break, which is a good chance to make sure you like our page at facebook.com/securityweekly. We like the likes. It makes us feel a little bit better. And then you can keep informed of our live broadcast. You can even ask questions if you're watching us live. I promise we'll answer them. And we'll be back in a minute with our innovation updates, including the big move Microsoft just made today.
Are your existing solutions able to take advantage of real threat intelligence? Common solutions like firewalls weren't designed to handle the massive and growing volume of threat indicators. This challenge often results in significant gaps in your protections, even when you think you have it covered. You need to protect yourself by filtering network traffic against unique threat indicators in a way that allows you to act. Palo Wall by Bandora Systems is the solution that filters over 10 million indicators right out of the box. Developed in partnership with the Department of Defense, Palo Wall is affordable for companies of all sizes. Get your free trial today at BanduraSystems.com. Rapid7 powers the practice of SecOps. Using shared data, analytics, and automated workflows, SecOps unites IT, DevOps, and security teams to make security an outcome of innovation. Rapid7 combines technology, expertise, and advocacy to drive vulnerability management, application security, incident detection, and log management for more than 7,000 organizations worldwide. Power up your SecOps practice with a free trial at rapid7.com/securityweekly.
We were off last week. There's a holiday in the U.S., and that means we've got 2 weeks worth of innovation updates, number of exits, big move by Microsoft this week, all sorts of other stuff Paul and I are about to get into. But first, let me tell you about something we're doing a little bit different. We've got a partnership with LogRhythm and a webinar coming up with them in about 2 weeks, Thursday, June 14th, 3 p.m. Eastern. It's Flag Day, so it's a good day for you to be patriotic if you're here in the U.S. But we're doing something different with this one. Paul's going to talk in a second about some of our topics, but we've got a small survey. We've timed it. It's 2 minutes, and you give us your take on a couple of important things, and we're actually using that two ways. We're going to influence the content of the webinar. Paul and I are going to co-host that along with our partners, LogRhythm. We're going to talk about some of those findings and give you some insights and strategies on that, And if you join us on that webinar, you can also see how you do relative to your peers. And it's always an important thing. You never want to be too far ahead of the curve. You certainly don't want to be behind it. You want to be right on it or right on the leading edge. This will give you a chance to see how you're doing relative to everybody else and influence the way that we meet your particular needs. Paul, what do you think we're going to talk about? What are we seeing so far?
Yeah, I think this really, too, in reviewing all the survey results and having a great conversation with Logrhythm, and you know, there's a couple more to follow in preparation for this webcast. One, I think educating the market about UEBA and where it stands, where it falls, and where it shines today was a huge point of contention. I mean, looking at the results, I was like, wow, like, I think like a lot of people don't know what it is. Yep. Some people that do maybe know where it is don't understand where it fits. And that's not, and I'm not picking on our audience by any stretch, because look, I'm struggling to figure out where it fits too because of the evolution. It's a concept that we've used in the past. Last year or 2 years ago, it really emerged that there were startups that did just that. Now it's being slowly absorbed back in. So confusion around this, I think, is natural, and we're going to run through it. The other thing that I thought was interesting from the survey that I want to talk about is the number of security solutions you're managing and how you're measuring the effectiveness of your security solutions. That's a hot topic today, too. We talk about attack simulation and the like, but you know, beyond that, or maybe in addition to that, how do you measure the success? And Michael's talked about this a lot, of course. How do you measure the effectiveness or the success of your solution? And that's something that enters in anytime you purchase something. How do you measure how effective it is, right? That can be very difficult depending on what it is, right? Is it some supplement, dietary supplement? Is it a security solution or anything in between? How do you know if it actually made an impact and you got value from it? So I think that's an important point too.
Yeah, no, I like it. And in fact, I like the way we're looking at it too, because the unwritten thing around UEBA right now, right, which we started as UBA, mm-hmm. then we added E, which is entity, to UEBA. There's still a lot of confusion around it. And one of the things we specifically ask, and I'd love your opinion on it so you can go take our survey and let us know, is it a feature or is it a platform? Mm. And are you expecting to see it? Or do you want it to still stand alone, but it needs to work? Like there's some nuance to that I think is really worth taking a look at. And then as soon as you contrast it against, well, hold on, why did you decide to use what you're using? And are you getting the value out of it that you expected? And how do you know? How are you testing it? How are you improving it? Whoa, when you start having those conversations, I see it as the foundation for some great stuff to happen in security. So that'll be Paul and I, Thursday, June 14th, 3 p.m. Eastern. And we're gonna try some stuff out. So hopefully it'll be fun. I can promise you it will be insightful. And if you participate in the survey and you join us on that webinar, we'll get you some of those results too. And I think that'll be pretty helpful. So Paul, let's talk about some of the big things this week. News kind of broke over the weekend. Confirmed this morning, Microsoft to acquire GitHub, $7.5 billion. I'm gonna give you a couple quick stats, and I'm curious your take on it. It's the fourth largest acquisition for Microsoft behind LinkedIn, Skype, and the Nokia phone business. Some of those have worked out better than others.
To say the least.
Yeah. Now, this is the crazy part to me. GitHub was valued at $2 billion in 2015. Only had two rounds of VC money into it. And I saw some of the stats in the article that I put up there along the lines of, you know, number of 28 million different people contributing to it. Like this is it. And Microsoft had a competing code repository that they shut down in December. So this
what
makes
sense. What
was
Microsoft's
sense.
Code? Well, it goes to show you how much market share Git and GitHub have. If you say Microsoft had one, and I don't immediately recognize what that was.
And it was the number two competitor too. Like it was the only other alternative. But then Microsoft said, you know what? We have 1,000 of our own engineers regularly contributing to GitHub. And I see this as it's that change, right? I mean, Microsoft has embraced, and I would even argue in some cases led the way along a lot of cloud computing stuff. They have a fantastic footprint. And I keep looking at, you know, when you're a Microsoft, when you're a Google, when you're one of these large, you know, Amazon-like companies, you've got money, you've got time, you can go figure some of these things out. So this is definitely a nod to open source and in a way of potentially supporting the community. Folks are obviously a little bit leery on it. How do you see it? Like, what is this, a super smart play on their part, or are you kind of looking at it going, I don't get it?
Well, first, I think it's pretty amazing that company based on open source software was just bought by Microsoft for $7.5 billion. Yeah. Like, I'm just, that's still sinking in, dude. Like, that's amazing. Because this is a product you can get for free if you want to set it up yourself. Now,
so suddenly that Slack valuation at $5 billion doesn't seem so crazy, does it?
Yeah, no, not at all. Now, what's interesting is that people will buy the GitHub version because it has nice features and it's all set up and it works. And I think there's also a security play in there as well. GitHub has made some strides into putting more security controls and security analysis into their system. They will find certain things. So I think that's interesting. And Microsoft buying them, really my market kind of take on this is Microsoft wants to be the leader in DevOps and cloud and the future of technology. This acquisition is so strategic for that because now if you think about Microsoft owns the source code repository, which, by the way, almost everyone's using and plays a large part in your DevOps process or your SecOps process or your DevSecOps pro, whatever you want to call it. Now they're going to tie it into Azure. And so that's just an awesome way to be a more major player in the space, which is great.
Yeah, and we're going to see how it shakes out, but I think we're watching a little bit of chess happen here too, where it's sometimes the play isn't so much about what you can do, it's about blocking somebody else. So blocking Amazon out of this or blocking Google out of this is a huge opportunity for them. And again, right, it's all the rumors that swirl around it, and obviously a lot of folks, or maybe not obviously, if you don't track it, GitHub, once they took on the VC funding, people said, whoa, what's the deal here? Like, how do we get involved? How do we buy you? How do we merge with you? So it was one of those, like, it raised eyebrows, and it's caught a lot of attention, and then I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. So we'll see where it goes. This was a week of a lot of acquisitions and other types of things mentioned, and none of them with any sort of money attached to it. But let's start with a real positive. We were just talking about Logrhythm, their partners. We really enjoy them. They've been around a lot longer, I think people realize. And after taking on $131.7 million in funding over multiple rounds, including a $50 million equity round in August of 2016, they sold a majority stake. They were acquired by Thoma Bravo, again, for an undisclosed amount. Now, when you look at this, this is one of those, right? Sometimes undisclosed is just, it's private equity. They don't have a tendency to disclose. And we've talked in years past about the watching Thoma Bravo. They're disciplined investors. They invest in software and they have a pretty robust security portfolio. And there's an article here in the Denver Post where our partners at Logrhythm said, yeah, this didn't just happen overnight. We were strategically looking for somebody that could help us grow. And then, so somebody said, oh, does this mean IPO? And I said, no, look, it's not out of the question, but it's also not what we're looking at right now. This gives us an infusion of all sorts of stuff and it lets us grow. We grow the product. So it's a growth round. It's not a surprising way to do it. This is something that we're seeing a lot more. And depending on how the deal got structured, this is what we start to see more and more now, is that when private equity comes in, the VCs get their money back. Now, we don't have the details on this one, and I'm not going to go ask Logrhythm for the details on this one either, except for to say, this is good. Like, I see this as a really positive sign. And from everything that we've been able to see around it, good, thoughtful decision-making on all sides. And I think this is really exciting. So congratulations to our friends at Logrhythm for that.
Yeah, congrats to Logrhythm.
And I think we'll see good stuff.
And the way my take on the Thoma Bravo investments is they tend to let their companies just like business as usual. Right, it doesn't seem like they're kind of heavy-handed investors where they're like changing gears and, you know, pivoting.
Yeah,
and all.
I mean,
like,
yeah,
it's pretty much like you're going to continue to do well.
Yeah, there's two basic types in private equity. The first one is, you know, it's the turnaround artists, the ones that come in and say, okay, you guys are good. I love the premise, but whoa, your systems are totally screwed up. We're going to rip all this out. We're going to pump you up, and then we're going to sell you for twice what we paid for you. Mm-hmm. By the way, valuable service center. There's nothing wrong with that. And I've met a lot of people that had worked in private equity that way that then said, you know what? That was great. And now I want to go help companies before they get to that point. Thoma Bravo tends to be along the other lines, which you mentioned, which is they go find healthy, good companies that need that infusion of cash or that need access to the other portfolio companies or to whatever they have. And so they want some of that strength of that management team and that other stuff. But it doesn't mean that they're fundamentally broken. It just means they're actually in really good shape. And this is a viable option for them. That's definitely what Thoma Bravo has as a reputation, and it's definitely what we've learned of Logrhythm. So again, I see this as a real positive sign, and I'm excited. And of course, then I'm excited to talk about what some of these topics look like in about 2 weeks. And, all right, KKR.
And, just really quick, while we're talking about Thoma Bravo, is DigiCert, who's also a sponsor of the Security Weekly Network, is also an investment from them for them.
Yeah, they have a couple more too that may or may not at different points been part of our family here at Security Weekly. But like I said, they're the second largest private equity investor in the security space. I think it's Vista Technology Partners is slightly ahead of them, and they also have a great track record. These are the companies I like to pay attention to because I think that they're signaling where they see things going.
Yeah.
And that's important, right? And so again, part of why we do these updates isn't just because we like talking about this stuff. It's to take a look and say, okay, security's busy. Everybody has got something that they need to be able to do. And one of the things that always fascinates me is if you're so busy to look to see what's out there, then how do you get better? How do you know? And I think that fits our theme of the day pretty well. So part of what we try to do is take a look at, well, who's getting funded? That's a bellwether. You know, if you take this concept that venture capital, private equity, institutional money is the new R&D, these are the people that are going out, they're building the networks and they're saying, hey, what works? What doesn't work? Where should we place our money? How do we get a return from it? Then understanding where those movements are. So saying, geez, Logarithm is doing really well. They've got Thoma Bravo. They've already got a plan for it. It's going to help their growth. It's going to help. Wow. Okay. So guys, they're not going away. They're sticking around. That's good. That's a good sign. You know, whereas some of these other, and I don't mean some of these other acquisitions, it's just companies that tend to do this, they've got a fighting chance, and if they're solving a problem you have, it might be worth a look. KKR acquired BMC for undisclosed. I tried to get my head wrapped around this. I don't have it completely figured out yet, and I got to check a fact here before I state it, and I can't check it fast enough on the fly. BMC, I mean, BMC's been around forever, my whole career. They went IPO August of 1988, Paul. I mean, I was in high school, so I don't remember it. But I can tell you, as long as I've been in the professional workforce, I've come across BMC stuff for years. So this basically now they're no longer public. They're now privately held by KKR. KKR has also made a lot of investments. I'm trying to remember a couple of them off the top of my head. They had a crypto platform. They had something else. And KKR bought the majority stake or took most of it from Blackstone for Optiv. So, you know, they're making big plays. And BMC, I mean, when you go to the site or, you know, you go to Owler and you take a look at it, I mean, they're in competition with the HPs of the world, the ServiceNows of the world, the CAs of the world. So this is an interesting play to me. But we've started to see now a lot of security companies that at one point were public are now taking on private equity. They're going private. And why? Because when you're public, you can't do any R&D. When you're public, your first and foremost responsibility as an executive is to return positive net value to the shareholders. Now, we see there's some activists and some folks in the CEO realms to say, no, it's about social good. Great, fantastic. By the way, those people are also outperforming the market. So you can say whatever you want as long as the returns are there. Call me a cynic, but that's kind of the way it works. So I think that this is just a trend. Like, I don't think it's good or bad. If anything, I think it's good. I didn't see anything that suggested BMC needed it. It's much more of a, this lets them do their restructuring. This, right? Company as large as BMC, been around as long as they have. This didn't particularly surprise me. The part that's more interesting to me is it's KKR. Okay. I keep trying to get my head wrapped around what a potential strategy looks like for KKR. Don't have it completely figured out yet, but I would say keep your eyes on it because it's going to be important. NoB4 acquired Exploqui. Is that how you'd say that, Paul? Exploqui?
I was trying to figure that out earlier, right. And I don't think I could come up with anything better.
Yeah, I'm not fancy, so I hope I didn't botch that. They specialize in concept development, production of explanatory films, interactive videos, informational graphics. So NoB4 is a security awareness company, and so this makes perfect sense. Keep in mind, too, so they took on a $30 million Series B October 2017, and then they acquired Popcorn Training in March of 2018.
Yeah, okay, now so that's acquired, where we cover them. So
yeah, we've covered them recently.
So because they made another acquisition of a similar kind of company. Well, and you know what? Right? These are smart acquisitions for them. It seems like they're just gobbling up competition or pseudo competition. Well, in either case, it's strengthening their portfolio, right?
Well, think about it, right? So Thoma Bravo, and I want to remember if they're the ones who took them private again, but they just took Barracuda private.
Yep.
And then Barracuda went and made a bunch of acquisitions in specifically this space.
Yep.
And then we saw, and it's escaped me, somebody else has recently done the exact same thing, mm-hmm. Right? And then FishMe combined, and then they changed their name, and I can't remember what they changed their name to. So what we see here with KnowBefore is it's a different strategy. Instead of getting consumed by somebody else, they're going out and consuming. And keep in mind, and I got to do this from memory, so I if I'm wrong, I'll correct myself next time, but Popcorn Training was in South Africa. And Exploqui is in Germany, mm-hmm. so they're also going global with some of these acquisitions. Like they're picking somebody that either has an existing library or a really cool capability that's going to let them extend and expand out. And so if you like their product, this type of thing, you know, this is what you're seeing from KnowBefore. So we've got some indicators that this type of thing becomes a feature. And now we've got some suggestion that no, there's still some folks that are fighting to make it more of a platform. And or, frankly, smart, they're making themselves a better acquisition target at a higher multiple in the future.
Yeah, I think these are shark-infested waters, and not in a negative way in any way, shape, form, or fashion, but I think we're going to see a lot more people getting swallowed up and a lot more people doing the market's just going to shrink in terms of number of companies in the space. If you're in the end-user security awareness education training market, even the larger, like outside of end-user security awareness and training, I think security training market is just, there's so many different players that you're going to see a lot of this very similar behavior go on for some time, I think.
And I think what you'll see too with this new round of focus and discipline and our frequent discussions of how do you measure effectiveness, I think we're going to start to get a sense of the things that actually work versus the things that we believe work. Because, you know, we want them to, because they feel good, because I like the little mouse moving across and everybody gets excited about it. Let's go look at what actually shifts behaviors in a consistent, demonstrable way, and we'll see where that goes. So it's a space that we continue to pay attention to. Fireman acquired Lumetta for undisclosed. Lumetta, cyber situational awareness, real-time network visibility, infrastructure analytics, they've taken on about $14.2 million in funding between debt and equity. And Fireman is I gotta look it up. I think they're a privately owned subsidiary of somebody else, and their security intelligence platform. You know, this doesn't really shock me. I'll tell you straight. The way I'm looking at this one, this is one of those undisclosed. It's what we call the aqua hire. Like, hey, yeah. I like your staff and your people, and you guys aren't really taking off for getting funding. So how about you come be part of our stuff and see if we can't revitalize it. I feel, Paul, like over the last year or two, we've talked about Fireman once or twice on Enterprise Security Weekly.
Yeah, sure. We cover
some of the
quite
stuff
often.
That they've done.
Yeah. So, also, I mean, we cover real-time network visibility. That's really in like probably 50% of the marketing and security companies out there.
Okay.
It's just
so this
I still don't really
gives them,
like what it means, really.
So this strengthens them and maybe even gives them access to a few more client bases that they didn't have.
Yeah. Yeah, and cool. I don't pretend to understand exactly what Lumetta does, and certainly their description isn't helping me either. In all fairness, I haven't taken a briefing with them or anything like that. But
ditto. Ditto.
Yeah.
All right. This one had an umlaut over the E, so I think it's Okira, or it had some other denoter. I apologize if I butchered that as well. $12 million Series A. So one of the things we've learned from our friend Will Lin is that's not a Series A. It's on the cusp between an early stage and a growth stage. But that's a $12 million Series A says, hey, you're pretty good. And that's a pretty good run rate. Data access, provisioning, accessing, governing, auditing of data and cloud environments. So here's what we're seeing here. It's access. That usually means some form of identity or management, and it's cloud. So these are two things that are pretty big. I'll be blunt. I went to the website. Looks nice. If you ask me to encapsulate the problem they're trying to solve, it wasn't really clear to me. They basically said, you don't have to choose between agility and governance. You can have both. And I went, cool. The hell are you talking about? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's ESWs where we're going to say what we think, but I think we're going to do that here too. So good. I mean, that's a good raise. So first of all, congratulations. That's a hell of a raise. And they must have something that's got people excited and or a pedigree that's got people excited. So I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying, you know, the way we look at stuff in terms of what problem you're trying to solve, what's the value you create for me, right? Especially with how quickly do you return that value and what's your overall impact. I looked at the website. I didn't really get anything around it. I just got that you can have governance and agility from your data at the same time. And I went, cool. Is that something I want? Where does that fit? I don't know. Signified, $100 million $1 million Series D. You know, that would have seemed awesome right up until when we said $7.5 billion for GitHub. But $100 million Series D, that's a big congratulations. They closed a $56 million Series C just last year, May of 2017. Now, remember, we look at this and we say, typically, if you close a round, including a Series C round, so Series C at this point in 56 million is growth round. That means you got to pay for marketing, you got to expand your sales team, you got to pay the commissions on that, you've got to do everything you can, build out your field operations, just go, go, go. That's how you're going to grow and how you're going to build. We typically want to see around last 2 years. I don't take this as a bad sign, because the other thing that we've learned is that if you're in the hot marketplace and there's too much demand, or people are so excited for it, that your investors are actually going to try to get in more and push you faster, but support you. They're not going to push you faster to the point of failing. I look at this one, I go, that's exactly, look, they help e-commerce businesses detect fraud and prevent credit card chargebacks. I totally understand that. More importantly, and Jack, my good friend Jack Daniel's not here to have this debate, but if you've heard us over the last couple of years, Jack and I have debated chip and pin and EMV and whatever you want to call it for a long time. And all I've pointed out is that in-person fraud, not a big deal. Online fraud is going to be an exponential growth area. And that chip and pin, the way we went about it here in the U.S., was just going to transfer that. And guess what? The economics bear out. And Signified says, hey, we're going to help you as a business, and we've got a guarantee, and they've got a pretty cool looking guarantee. We're going to detect that fraud. We're going to prevent those chargebacks. We're going to help you out. Of course they're growing. Of course they're doing great. They've taken on about $200 million of funding so far, and I think this just signifies that Signified is doing the right stuff, and people are pretty jazzed up about it. So good for them, and more good growth on the way from them. Have you come across it? I mean, do you see it differently? Because you typically sit between Jack and I when we have these conversations. Do you have any insights, or do you need to represent Jack?
No, I let you guys duke that one out. I stay out of that. I'm staying out of that one.
And it'll surprise people, because Jack and I aren't that far apart. He wants to be able to buy a train ticket in Amsterdam. I'm looking at the global economics of what we've done. But anyway. And much love to Jack. Jack and I are friends. At least I think we are. I'm kidding. All right, Cyberbit, last one, $30 million equity round. Now, what's interesting about them is they're a wholly owned subsidiary of a large Israeli company. I've talked to their CEO a couple of times, and I've come away thoroughly impressed every time. So this to me, and if you go look at why they took the money, it's an equity round. And what it lets them do is expand their sales and marketing, especially in North America. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I'll be fair, one of the things that really stood out to me, and I'm really excited about what they do, is a cybersecurity training and simulation. We've had on Pulse Security Weekly some of our cyber warriors now. I think the work the National Guard is doing on this front is phenomenal. And we create these ideas of cyber ranges. And if you roll your eyes, you're missing out on it, because what I got to witness firsthand, when you can do these types of simulations and you've got that set, is two things. One, I can show somebody real time who's not part of this world at all. I can come in and I can show them what it's like. I can show them what a red team's like. I can show them what a blue team's like. I can show them what we're able to monitor, what we can see, how it all works, and I can show them. And when they can see that and ask questions, it completely changes their perspective.
Yeah, but I'm just confused about Cyberbit. Like, are they an endpoint detection and response company, or are they a cyber range and training and simulation company, or are they both? I don't get it.
Yeah, so here's the take I got from them, and this is going to lead into my second point, and this is where I got kind of excited. They said, okay, you're telling us we don't have enough people that have hands-on experience, and we have a cyber shortage. What if I could give you the way to train them through simulations using real data in the environment? And as they progress up, now you've got your SOC 1 analyst or your SOC 2 analyst or whatever it is that you want, and they're getting better at it because they're learning on the job, and we're able to guide them. So you didn't have to have a computer security degree or study anything relative to security at all. But if you have certain aptitudes, we can invite you in, we can test you, we can work with it. This to me is the kind of stuff that I get excited about, because I see it making a difference in our industry. I've never really looked at them from an endpoint detection and response platform. They've got some pretty impressive stuff that they've done in Israel. But where I got excited was the SOC automation and then that training and simulation. And I think their story, without putting words in Adi's mouth, is they have the ability to say, look, we understand how all this stuff works and that data. Now I can simulate it for you so you can learn how to do it too, and you'll be better as a result. So I'm at least excited about it. And again, this is the kind of stuff, right? $30 million, that's a growth round. Like, you just look at the number. And I don't care whether it's equity, what it's got a number next to it. That's a growth round. And as a growth round, guess what? They're going to focus on sales and marketing. They pick the marketplace, and they know what they want to do with it. That is 100% a growth round. So maybe, Paul, we'll get a chance to get a briefing with them and understand a little better about what their plans look like and how that works. Those are the updates. That's a lot of stuff. All right, let me tell you quick. You can get me on Twitter at Catalyst. You can get Paul at Security Weekly. You can hit me up or both of us or either of us up on LinkedIn. You can find places to send an email. And we read it. We read all of it, and we act on it, and it's planning future segments and everything else. Now, I'm off next week. I've got to go work with a client. They've got a team offsite, and I'm really excited. Of course, that means I won't be here live. Paul will be here, and we got Masha Sadova from Elevate Security. And I'm actually kind of bummed because, Paul, I've seen a couple interviews with Masha, and let me just say we would get along exceptionally well in terms of our attitudes and approach. She's got a great background. If you're looking at how to work with people, or you're looking at stuff around security awareness, you're going to totally want that. Next week, you can catch us live. We're on Facebook and YouTube Mondays, 1 o'clock Eastern. And I guarantee it's going to be a show packed with actionable insights. Until then, remember, the exceptional leaders elevate the people around them because they made the right investments in themselves. Here's the great week of you making yourself better so the people around you get better results. See you 2 weeks. Paul, be here next week.
Take care, Michael. Thank you.